Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. For the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. General Motors to idle plants and cut thousands of jobs as sales slow. General Motors announced today that it plans to idle five factories in North America and cut more than 14,000 blue-collar and salary jobs in a bid to trim costs. The action follows similar job-cutting moves by Ford Motor in the face of slowing sales and a shift in consumer taste, driven in part by low gasoline prices. And it drew fire from President Trump, who vowed early in his term to increase automaking jobs and brought pressure on the industry not to shift work to Mexico and overseas. Does this indicate anything about the U.S. economy that President Trump has been heralding as the greatest of all time? Well, for this, we turn to my first guest. He's a professor in and former chair of the Department of Economics at Howard University and serves as chief economist to the AFL-CIO, Dr. William Spriggs. Dr. Spriggs, welcome to The Critical Hour.
Thank you for having me.
So first, when you heard this announcement by General Motors that came after the Ford Motor announcement, what were your thoughts?
Well, General Motors had announced this a while back that they were likely to make this announcement. So it wasn't a surprise. The big problem in the U.S. is that wages have not been going up. And despite the fact that we have very low unemployment, and despite the fact that traditionally when the nation is adding construction jobs, the auto industry does well. This lack of rising wages means that the demand for automobiles isn't anywhere near where it would normally be with unemployment this low.
Is that because American automobiles aren't keeping pace with their foreign competitors? Is it that automobile sales in the country, across the country overall, are slowing down? Or do Trump's tariffs have anything to do with this?
Well, Trump's tariffs don't have anything to do with the slowdown in auto sales. It's the failure of American companies to raise the wages of all workers.
So that they can afford to go out and buy cars?
They have to be able to afford to go out and buy cars. And the pay hasn't kept pace. And so the result is that right now, auto sales should be booming, but they're not, because pay is not booming. Income is not booming. And so that's the big dilemma that the United States faces. And until we can get wages up, we can't solve these problems. Remember, with these relatively low oil prices, the number one selling vehicles in the United States are trucks and SUVs, and American-made. The number one auto sales are Ford trucks, Chevy trucks. So, you know, everybody thinks, oh, it's because people are shifting to smaller cars. Smaller cars aren't selling. That's not what's happening here.
There are two words in this announcement that piqued my interest. One, Ford announced that it's idling factories. It did not say closing them. So does idle indicate a temporary move, or is that just a softer way of saying close? And the other question has to do with, of the 14,000 jobs, 14,000 blue collar jobs, and they're laying off 8,000 salaried positions. So does the white collar move indicate something in the context of this labor shift?
Well, idling means that they're not shutting the plant down. They are lowering the production because of the weak sales. The shift in white collar workers in part reflects that if you idle a plant, or if you shut, in the case of General Motors, they are shutting down plants. Then that means, you know, there are certain white collar workers you don't need because you have fewer workers. And part of this reflects a shift going forward the companies are going to try and increase their position in electric cars. And so they're trying to redeploy some of their skills that way. And then in anticipation of other steps against global warming, they're trying to do a better job of taking their space and other modes of transportation. The big deal in what's going on with people using mass transportation and Uber is the dilemma of what's called the last mile. And as you can see, what has become popular in many cities are things like bike rentals.
Yeah, bike share programs.
Bike share programs. People are renting scooters even.
Yes.
So they want to make sure that they have a place in that market as well. So they want to be able to change focus and be able to do some of these new efforts as well.
Dr. William Spriggs, greatly appreciate you joining us on the Critical Hour. Look forward to having you back.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, sir. Have a good evening. Republican Cindy Hyde-Smith is running for re-election against the Democrat Mike Espy, former President Bill Clinton's Secretary of Agriculture and a former six-year congressman from Mississippi. Senator Hyde-Smith brings the baggage of Mississippi and America into tomorrow's runoff election. President Trump is hosting two rallies for her today. They want to be sure that this one does not get away. For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. First, my first guest is an American scientist and the Associate Dean for Research and Professor of Biological Studies at the Joint School for Nanoscience and Nanoengineering, which is jointly administered by North Carolina Agricultural and Technical State University, as we know affectionately as A&T, and UNC Greensboro. His focus is on the biology of race, and he has authored two books, The Emperor's New Clothes, Biological Theories of Race at the Millennium, and The Race Myth, Why We Pretend Race Exists in America. He is Dr. Joseph Graves. Dr. Graves, welcome to the Critical Hour.
Thank you for having me on tonight.
We're also joined by the new executive director of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored Persons, NAACP, Mississippi State Conference, Mr. Corey Wiggins. Mr. Wiggins, welcome to the Critical Hour.
Hey, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Let me start with Mr. Wiggins, and please talk right into your phone. It's been reported that two nooses and several hate signs were found hanging at the Mississippi State Capitol this morning around 7:15. Capitol Police would not show the signs or surveillance video while they're actively investigating. With that reality, what is your sense on the eve of this election for U.S. Senate Mississippi?
You know, I think in terms of where we are in the eve of this, is folks on the ground here in Mississippi are excited about this opportunity to go and vote and to exercise their currency. But what I will say in this is that we also recognize that the work of how we got to this point has been a long time coming, a long time building of power here in Mississippi with the likes of folks like Medgar Evers, who sacrificed his life for this work, folks like Fannie Lou Hamer here in Mississippi. And this is just a constant sort of a result of people on the ground here in Mississippi working to ensure that African Americans and all Mississippians have access to all the opportunity here in the state.
Dr. Graves, Senator Hyde-Smith, in paying homage to a supporter, is on record as having said if the supporter had invited her to a public hanging, she would have been in the front row. She also says that laws that make it just a little more difficult for certain individuals or students to vote is a great idea. She's also tied to Mississippi's Confederate history as well as their Jim Crow past. What signals does this send to you based upon your research and your experience?
Well, these symbols are clear indications of white supremacist ideology. The history of the Confederacy is one of racism, the oppression of people of African descent, of American Indians, the denial of human rights on a massive scale. The Confederacy was founded for the very purpose of continuing the institution of chattel slavery And in fact, for those who try to claim that, you know, liking or loving the Confederacy is an issue of heritage, not hate, all they have to do is read the secession documents, particularly the secession documents from the state of Mississippi, which were amongst the most and overtly claimed that the reason they were seceding was to maintain the supremacy of the white race.
Mr. Wiggins, again, tomorrow, Tuesday, is the runoff vote for national Senate seats. Senator Sidney Hyde-Smith running against Mike Espy. Now, some analysts say that this whole thing is going to come down to turnout. As a political scientist, I say all elections come down to turnout, but that's just me. With the history of voter suppression and the problems that we've seen as evidenced in whether it's North Dakota with Native Americans, whether it's in Georgia with what went on in that election, do you have concerns in Mississippi about voter suppression tactics? And we know that tactics take different forms depending on the target audience and also depending upon the state. So are you, as with the NAACP, having issues about voter suppression tactics tomorrow?
Yes, no, we're having concerns about that. One of the things that we do here in Mississippi is for every election, we have a command center for election protection. For anybody in the state that's having issues voting, they're able to call our hotline. We have our NAACP branch members that are deployed across the state for any issues that are coming up at any of the precincts. Just today, in coalition with the Lawyers Committee, we filed a lawsuit here in Mississippi related to absentee voting. And so as it relates to voter suppression, is something that we're always concerned about. It's something we always are working to address here in Mississippi. But I think something, as you said, was very important, that turnout does matter. And turnout does matter in all elections that happen. And what I can say, regardless of the outcome of the election, is that a number of folks across Mississippi and in communities, particularly in African-American community, have been engaged. Our members of the NAACP have been knocking on doors, even for the general election, over 100,000 doors, and encouraging people to get out to vote for the general election and for this runoff. And so people are excited. People are engaged in this and ensuring that people are exercising their rights. But so much of our work is not only getting people out to vote, but when people show up at the polls, making sure that they can cast their vote.
Dr. Graves, in the larger national context, there's a new Quinnipiac poll out revealing the majority of Americans are in agreement in their disapproval surrounding Trump's handling of race relations, except for two key demographics, Republican voters and white men. Nearly 60% of those surveyed said they did not approve of the president's handling of race relations, with stark comparisons between Republicans and Democrats on the issue. 76% of Republicans said they supported Trump when it comes to race relations. 4% of Democrats agreed. More than 90% of black people disapproved of the president on race. So in the larger national context, again, based upon your incredible research and your experience, what in the world happened to our race-neutral post-Obama America?
Well, first, I would have told you that race neutral when Obama became elected president. So that myth needs to be swept away to begin with, because those same racial antagonisms were there even during the election, which brought Barack Obama into the White House. Now, the Republican strategy, which was coined, you know, essentially was directed, developed by Richard Nixon, the so-called Southern strategy, was completely designed to make the Republican Party the party of white middle-class people. That was their aim, and they've essentially succeeded in doing so.
Hence Ronald Reagan announcing his campaign in Philadelphia, Mississippi. Of all the metropolises in the world, he went to Philadelphia, Mississippi.
Which supports my point. Their program has always been one of maintaining the institutional bulwarks that sustain racism in the United States and give unfair advantage to persons of European descent. That's what they're about. That's what they've always been about. That's what Trump ran on. And so, you know, we, of course, see that people who are being benefited by these policies are the ones that support them, whereas the vast majority of Americans are not being benefited. And the real sad part of this is when you talk about Republicans, there's a large number of working-class people who have been voting Republican, and they've been voting against their own class interests because, in fact, the policies that this party puts in place do not benefit them. Witness today, GM deciding to lay off workers in several plants, even though Trump claimed he was angry at them. This is just a logical continuation of these policies. And so long as people are fooled into thinking that the wealthiest Americans really have the interests of poor working-class people at heart, we're going to continue to go back in this pendulum between Democrat, Republican, Democrat, Republican, and no way forward can be found. Really need to take a look at what really drives this economy. And if we don't start asking the hard questions about who the economy benefits and how we need to change it so that it benefits all Americans and not just the wealthiest Americans, we're not going to find a way out of this quandary.
Mr. Wiggins, we have about a minute and a half left. I remember Haley Barbour on television saying that there is a new Mississippi, and we don't tolerate racism in Mississippi. In fact, he said, we never had the Klan in Mississippi. We had the White Citizens Council. And in my opinion, that was just the Klan in suits. Then, of course, we've got Trent Lott. We had Senator Trent Lott, and I know he's still wandering the earth. Is there a new Mississippi, or have the tactics changed? And we've got about a minute and a half left.
You know, that's a very interesting question and sort of posed in that way. And what I would say is this is not about a new Mississippi. This is about what Mississippi is today. Yes, we have issues or challenges, and the battle scars, the history of hatred still exists today. But I also say that there's a number of on-the-ground activists, people who stand up on the shoulders of giants, who are here fighting and carrying out the type of Mississippi that we want to see for our future and for our children. So it's not so much about a new Mississippi. This is the Mississippi that we have today. And we have so many freedom fighters who are engaged and involved in the work today to ensure that we have a Mississippi that is just, a Mississippi that is fair, and a Mississippi that works for all citizens and not just a few.
Mr. Corey Wiggins, thank you so much. The new congratulations, Executive Director of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored Persons, as well as Dr. Joseph Graves. Dr. Graves, thank you for your work, and sir, thank you both for coming to the Critical Hour. Look forward to having the both of you back.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And to those who are listening, those of you in Mississippi, go out and vote tomorrow. It is important. No matter which candidate is your favorite, do participate. Hey, folks, you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. In the wake of some of the most powerful hurricanes on record and historic wildfires in California, the Trump administration's strategy on climate, try to bury its own scientific report on global warming, is the approach that they're taking. The Trump White House, which has defined itself by a willingness to dismiss scientific findings and propose its own facts, last Friday issued a scientific report that directly contradicts its own global warming policies. So what's going on here? For insight, we turn to my next guest. He's a former physicist who writes out his analysis of physical or societal problems or interactions. He joins us to discuss his latest counterpunch piece, Climate Change Action Would Kill Imperialism. Manuel Garcia Jr., welcome to the Critical Hour.
Thank you for inviting me.
Before we get to your counterpunch piece, Climate Change Action Would Kill Imperialism, your thoughts on the stories from Friday and today that the Trump administration has released this report, but is now in either due to hypocrisy or schizophrenia, it is contradicting itself.
Well, I don't think there's anything unusual about that in terms of the Trump administration. The business community, really worldwide, has understood climate change is real for a long time. But of course, to actually act on it would undermine their whole economic activity, self-aggrandizing activity. So you have, on the one hand, the obfuscation for the public to keep them, as it were, buying and on the tether, while on the other hand, they themselves are very seriously taking climate change into account and working on it. For example, just recently, the American government decided to underwrite the cost of building seawalls along the Gulf Coast of Texas to protect oil refineries that they are worried about being inundated by the rising level of the sea because of climate change. So, you know, deep down, they know what's going on, and they're just playing the usual game that people play of trying to keep their advantages and keep everybody else confused and befuddled.
Before I get into a little more detail about this 1,600-page national climate assessment, let me ask your assessment as a physicist about building these seawalls to deal with global warming. Does building these seawalls actually make some sense?
Well, okay. Let's put it this way. It makes sense from a insane point of view. For example,
I like that.
Some time ago, in the Obama administration already, when the Arctic ice was, was less Arctic ice, there was this frenzy of the petroleum industry, helped by the government, was saying, well, great, now we can rush into the Arctic and pump oil year-round because we can put wells in, sea wells in.
Sure.
Because there's less ice. So, the logic there is that what we're doing is causing CO2 in the atmosphere, which is melting the Arctic and causing climate apocalypse, as I call it, coming toward us. So what could be better than the climate apocalypse that we're creating is making it easier for us to do more of it. And so it's the same thing. I mean, you have these refineries. There's a huge concentration of refineries along the Gulf Coast. And what do? They refine now the pumped down, tar sands, the oil shale.
Mm-hmm.
And they refine this stuff. What are we going to do? They're going to burn it, and we're going to keep the old system going. And it's going to, it's causing the problem we all understand here in this segment. And so what would be the logical thing to do? Well, the logical thing to do from the keep making money perspective is to protect those things so we can keep pumping out more CO2 so we can kill ourselves, by climate change. I mean, that's why I say it's logical from an insane point of view. The aspect of it that rankles, at least me and other people, is that they're using taxpayer money to protect the industry that is in large part creating the problem that is killing us all. And so another way of using the taxpayer money would be for a wider public interest to say, look, why don't we, for instance, take a few trillion dollars and do an infrastructure program, the kind that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has championed,
mm-hmm.
and put a lot of people to work, and create tons of green energy systems, which are not that complicated, really. And we didn't need so much fossil fuel. We could spew out less of it and even invest in some speculative technology now for extracting it out of the atmosphere. And so there's that aspect of it. So that's the direction from which I come.
Let me just explain to the audience that the report that we're talking about, the National Climate Assessment, a 1,656-page report, which is required by Congress, It's the most comprehensive. I'm just letting my audience understand.
Oh, yes, I understand.
It's the most comprehensive scientific study to date detailing the effects of global warming on the United States economy, public health, coastlines, and infrastructure. And it describes in precise detail how the warming planet will wreak hundreds of billions of dollars of damage in coming decades. I know that President Trump has questioned the science, but as a physicist, and I'm sorry if this is a silly question, but just to kind of put the stake in the ground.
Yes.
How exact is this global warming science that that the Trump administration and other conservatives want to refute?
Well, okay. I've actually written about that. Let me very briefly just give you a quick history.
Okay.
The idea of CO2 global warming was realized by a physicist called Arrhenius in the 1890s. It was championed by papers written by an American woman physicist in the 20s and 30s who was not recognized until recently. And in the 30s, a British scientist revived Arrhenius's research and published on it. And in 1955, in the journal Nature, the definitive article doing a complete scientific, you know, A to Z on climate change, global warming being caused by CO2 emission, by human activity, was published in Nature. In 1957, in the journal TELUS, T-E-L-U-S, the two authors who had done that critical research published a joint paper that described it. In 1962, I happen to own a copy of this wonderful book on aerodynamics written by a British industrial physicist.
Okay.
And it was published in 1962.
Okay.
In 1962, and in it, it states that we know that, you know, human activity, burning of coal, puts CO2 in the atmosphere, and the Earth is warming, and they give estimates of that.
Okay. All right.
As we know, in 88, Hansen came out with a statement. So we've known about this for a long time.
A long time. Okay.
And it's, you know, there's, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, is the Earth flat?
I was just going to say, we know two things. We know the Earth, we know the world is round.
Right.
And we know that it's warming. And we know that it's warming because of human activity.
Okay. Exactly.
Okay.
So, I mean, you know, the questioning of it is, well, it's ridiculous.
Okay. Okay. And folks, we're talking to Manuel Garcia Jr., a physicist who writes on physical and social problems. And we're talking now about his latest piece, Climate Change. Climate Change Action Would Kill Imperialism. And that, I think your analysis here is amazing to me. American political power is based on fossil fuels, and the U.S. military is the engine that consumes those fuels to produce that power. So long as there's an American political elite that craves lucrative personal prestige and the ability to dominate internationally, the U.S. economy will be fossil-fueled capitalism that maintains the military colossus that enables and protects those elite ambitions. You talk about imperial power in two varieties. Explain first the hard power, then the soft power, please.
Well, I mean, I see it as you say, a hard power. Hard power is what most people think of as military power. You know, the U.S. has this military ability to invade, like Iraq, invade Afghanistan, to control territory, to put soldiers, boots on the ground, tanks, bomb from our airplanes, basically take over territory. And our Navy can you know, monopolize or guard sea lanes that, for instance, to protect them from piracy or pirates or other nations who would predate on tanker traffic. So, for example, the U.S. Navy, some estimates are that the amount of money the U.S. spends on its military to guard the sea lanes in the Strait of Hormuz and mm-hmm. Suez and, you know, all of that is equivalent to you know, it's huge. I mean, it's huge. So that's what I mean by hard power.
And we know, for example, that China on the other side their Navy out in the South China Sea. They are they are protecting those sea lanes, not necessarily to protect oil traffic, but between their Belt and Road Initiative and their Made in China 2025, they want to be sure that they're able to use those sea lanes to ship their products and so on and so forth. So I just wanted to.
Yeah, well, there's also a lot of speculation about oil deposits near the Spratly Islands and all of that. So, you know, everybody's playing these games. Mm-hmm. Everybody's military. And then the other aspect you asked about
The soft power, yes.
The soft power, I view that as, well, you know, we have this military colossus. I mean, other countries have too, China, but the U.S. has this military colossus. And the soft power is, for example, all these arms sales. We sell arms to Israel, and, you know, that enables them to do their little mini imperialism in their area, which is consistent with U.S. aims of regional control. And, for example, the obvious one is the huge arms sales we do to Saudi Arabia, which enable them to, you know, bomb the Yemenis genocidally and have their control. But the thing about arms sales is, if you want to go back into history, you can read about the satraps, the client kings of the Persian Empire. But the idea is that, you know, the superpower tells a lesser power, here, we're going to give you the armaments you need to, you know, maintain the sphere of influence you want to maintain. And out of gratitude to us, you're going to do us a few favors. And among the favors the U.S. likes to get from the opulent Saudi royalty are things like keep the production of oil high, because low oil prices result, and we like that for greasing our capitalism. And also, here, undercutting the price of oil does things like undercut the Venezuelan socialism, which is relying on their fossil fuel sales to try to
save their economy,
do economic development in their country. And places like Iran sells fossil fuels also. I mean, all these things are causing global warming, but still, poorer countries that happen to have this highly desired resource, you know, are stuck between, are we going to sit here and not globally warm and let our people starve to death? We're going to sell it on the open market, use the money and try to do economic development in our nation, and then maybe eventually evolve or develop technology that can get us away from it. Which is why the Iranians actually wanted to have nuclear power, because they viewed the oil they had as something to sell, to bring money into the country, to raise the economic standards, and then use nuclear power to sustain themselves without having to rely on the oil. Not that I like nuclear power, but I'm just explaining that that's the aspect of soft power. The U.S. can use its ability to induce, sell, or propel the militarism elsewhere as, you know, in client regime sort of style.
Well, say it's also, we only have a couple minutes. It's also important when you talk about Iran and nuclear power to understand the Adams for Peace program back in the 50s. It was the United States that introduced. So it's just an interesting cycle that Iran can have nuclear power, but we're the ones that initially back in the 50s tried to sell it to them. So Westinghouse could sell nuclear reactors all around the world.
Yes. There's a whole thing about nuclear power, you know, that we could go off it forever on that.
Let me quickly get to this, because I found this point that you made to be incredibly, incredibly powerful. You say, because of the fracking oil shale boom of the last two decades, the U.S. now produces as much oil as Saudi Arabia and is energy independent as a fossil-fueled economy, but hegemonic ambition compels it to seek global control of petroleum distribution, because to control the flow of oil around the globe is to throttle the imperial ambitions and economic development plans of all others. And to your point early in the conversation about why we're not moving towards green forms of energy, that paragraph that you just wrote, I thought was incredibly profound and incredibly powerful.
Well, I hope it stimulates some thinking with more people.
And because, to your point, as you mentioned earlier, there's so much residual impact that could come from green technology investment, that to continue to drill these holes in the ground is a waste of resources.
I've always, you know, actually, I was in graduate school in the 70s during the first oil crisis, during the Carter administration. And one of the things I realized then was that, you know, the petroleum we have, we can think of it as a stopgap. What we should have done, you know, back in 73 and on, 73, 79, the years of that crisis, what we should have done was to say, look, we've got a temporary resource of energy, these fossil fuels. Use them to power the building of an alternative green energy system. Because the green energy systems, you know, we're talking solar, hydro, and wind. These things were known from way back, okay?
Right. Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's nothing really new about it, except modern technology and computers can do them maybe more efficiently. But the essential parts of it, the physical parts of it, are ancient. And so we could have built a huge system that would have powered the country. I mean, let me give you a statistic that may surprise you. If we took solar energy, solar power, we collected solar power on 1% of the land area of the United States of America and converted it with only 2% efficiency to electricity, that would power the entire electrical energy use of the United States, 4 trillion kilowatt hours per year.
Wow.
So, you know, you could take a fraction of the state of Arizona and put solar energy farms and power all the power in that is used electrically in this country. It's not going to power airplanes and tanks, but it powers the grid.
Mm-hmm.
And we can plug in anything you can plug in. So the other aspect of this is that if, you know, there is more than enough land, public land owned by the U.S. government in warm areas and any sunny area to do this. So it is theoretically possible for the U.S. government to do solar energy farms on totally federal-owned land and collect enough energy to give the country free electricity without having to have any utilities or any cost whatsoever, because it's a public investment.
And then
these things are physically possible. They're not high in the sky.
Got it.
And then you look at something like the Sahara Desert. You can put energy farms across that and power, you can, maybe Europe could tap into the power and pay for it with enough to give Africa tremendous development further south.
I got to stop you there. Manuel Garcia Jr., Climate Change Action Would Kill Imperialism. You'll find it in Counterpunch. It's a great, great piece. Sir, thank you for your time today. Really appreciate you coming to the Critical Hour. Look forward to having you back.
Thank you very much for the invitation. I enjoyed it.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right, folks, you are listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Migrants in Tijuana run to U.S. border but fall back in face of tear gas. A few hundred migrants tried to evade Mexican police and U.S. Border Patrol and cross from the Tijuana-Mexico border into San Diego over the weekend. The U.S. Customs and Border Patrol Agency responded by firing tear gas and closing the border in both directions. A few thousand of the immigrants from Central America have been living in a shelter in Tijuana. What's really going on here at the Tijuana-San Diego border? For insight, we turn to my next guest. She's a Mexican native who's been advocating for immigrant rights for nearly 20 years. She founded Latino Advocacy in 2010, is the spokesperson for Northwest Detention Center Resistance, and the Seattle Globalist honored my guest with the 2018 Globalist of the Year Award for her activism in the area of migrant rights. She is Ms. Maru Mora Villapando. Welcome back to The Critical Hour.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be back.
Thank you. First of all, congratulations on, it's belated, but still, congratulations on your receiving the 2018 Globalist of the Year Award.
Well, thank you. It is an honor.
First, tell us, what is your understanding of what actually happened at the Tijuana border over the weekend? Was it as simple as a few thousand migrants charged the border and Border Patrol fires back with tear gas? Was it that simple?
Absolutely not. I think it's important to understand that the border crossings have been actually going down for the past 2 years. And most importantly, that migration to the United States through that border, to the southern border, is not new. What is important for us to also put in context is that the U.S. has an international obligation of letting people come in into the country and go, if they want to apply for asylum, go through a very difficult and long process of asylum applications. And last, I think it's important to also understand how the Mexican government has permitted the Department of Homeland Security to enter Mexican territory. They have been working with the U.S. government to really criminalize these people as they're going through the Mexican territory. And actually, let's just remember, lately there was the case of a young man, a teenager, Mexican national, that was fatally wounded by a border patrol from the other side of the border. This young man was not even on U.S. territory and was shot on the back. So I think it's important to recognize how both countries have been collaborating to criminalize and actually to be violent against migrants, either from Central America or even Mexican nationals in Mexican territory.
Do you think that the Trump administration created this issue from the perspective that the U.S. has policies and processes in place to deal with those from Mexico, Central and South America who want to apply for citizenship? Now, though, and now those processes and policies, they're far from the best and they're far from being efficient, but there have been policies in place. It seems as though the Trump administration has thrown out the playbook, and this crisis is a result of the Trump administration just not even following the processes that are already established by American law.
That's right. The processes, as you mentioned, are very, very far from fair, but they're still there. And that's why we've been doing this work for so many years, to precisely expose how the immigration system is far from just. But still, we had a process. And yes, under the Trump administration, they really want to get away with everything and really undo any processes in the first place. Let's remember Jeff Sessions, who was recently the attorney general. He is the one that applied the zero tolerance policy, right? That as people were crossing the border, either applying for asylum or not, the people would be, regardless of the conditions, would be criminalized and placed with federal charges. They also have been placed now into indefinite detention. They're getting away with Supreme Court cases that have in the past prevented the indefinite detention of children, for example. So what this administration has done is that the big infrastructure of detention and deportation through the immigration policy system has been overdone or in some cases totally dismantled in the few instances where people had the right to follow a specific process. I think it's very clear that this administration is not only undoing the few processes that existed that people could use, but they're also utilizing communities, entire communities, thousands of people's victimization because of running away from crime and violence and poverty. He's using it to his own advantage to scapegoat our communities and to make it a political fight, not really a legal fight.
So what's really your understanding of what happened over this weekend with those who came to the border and the resistance that they met from Border Patrol?
I think I've been following the caravans for many years now. We're in touch with the organizers. The caravans were made precisely to protect migrants, because in Mexico, through the Mexican territory, migrants in general are victims of violence, rape, organized crime, I mean, you name it. So many people have been killed in Mexican territory just for trying to cross and make it to the U.S. border. I think it's the idea of the caravan was precisely to protect their road to the U.S. And what I understand is that basically some people decided to stay in the makeshift camps, and some others said, no, we're here to cross the border and to ask for asylum, and we're going to do just that. There was already Mexican federal police on site. At the same time, as we know, military have been sent already to the U.S. border. We understand that even the cross-border was shut down for the day, or at least for some hours. So even people that, you know, were driving back and forth between the border, as they've done for many decades, or people that were just doing some tourist trips, were stopped from going through the border altogether. And what we understand is that the military and all the enforcement on the U.S. side, as people, some of the people of the caravan tried to make it to the gates and through the border. Some people were like, "Well, we're just going to jump because we, you know, can you imagine? You're so afraid that that's your only chance of survival." So some people decided to do that, and what they encountered was gas and violence from the U.S. side. At the same time, the Mexican federal police started protecting the U.S. border, and they arrested people, and they put some people in deportation proceedings.
Donald Trump is defending the use of gas by the U.S. Border Patrol. Do you think that the situation at the border over the weekend deteriorated to a point to where that type of action needed to be taken? Or do you think that other less aggressive forms, and some would say that the use of tear gas was not nearly as aggressive as it could have been. So do you think that action by the U.S. border agents was really necessary?
Absolutely not. I mean, there's no excuse to have done that. I mean, it's clear that the U.S. shut down the border. The U.S. is not following their own international treaties to let people come in and apply for asylum. People that come in are also, might face the decision of not being allowed in. But at least you should be able to come in and say, hey, I want asylum or I want to go through. Then it's up to those authorities to say yes or no. And so what the U.S. did is get away with those U.S. treaties, international treaties, and they, what they did was to create enough,
concern or uncertainty?
Sentiments of uncertainty that people are fleeing for their lives. And so what people end up doing is being desperate. And feeling that, well, the only way I can do this is then to go through the border as many have done before. And so I think this was a very clear attempt by the U.S. administration to use their equipment against migrants. I think that it's very clear where the priorities of this administration are. You know, while so many fires have been ravaging California, he instead decided to send military down to the border instead of, you know, supporting the firefighters in California. There's so many other places where if we're going to have military, they should be helping instead of attacking people, especially people that are trying to flee from precisely violence and murder and criminalization in their countries.
My guest is Maru Mora Villalpando. She's a Mexican native. She's been an outspoken activist in supporting migrants for over 20 years. Do you think that this was the Trump administration trying to create the optics of chaos to make it easier for him to demand funding to build this border wall that he wants?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, to the point that when he announced that he just was sending, 1,500 troops to the border, it was just clear that he continues utilizing scapegoating, fear-mongering, And now it's just another way to excuse something that is very clear it doesn't work. It doesn't work in any sense. So many border communities have expressed their outrage at the idea of building a wall between them and their neighbors. Again, this administration is really good at inventing or creating crises in the first place. I think this president still thinks he's a TV star, and he treats everything as a TV show, as a reality show, while at the same time is trying to hide the fact of reality. So, for example, the climate justice report that was released on Friday, on a weekend that is off, that most people are taking off and are with their families, they really decided to release this climate justice report that really goes against the administration's denial of climate change. They did it in a very hidden way, while at the same time they were ready to go against migrants and respond with violence. So I think it's very, very, very clear. There are people out there that still are doubting this is all a political game, and people's lives are in danger, especially if in any of your audience have ever experienced being in a crowd and then having to breathe that gas that is used by enforcement. It's really dangerous.
It is. I have been subjected to tear gas in crowds in two instances, and you're absolutely right. Once you add the size of and the motion of the crowd to your gasping for air and wondering if you're going to be able to take another breath, that injects a whole nother level of fear into the process. Let me ask you this about Mexican president-elect Andrés Manuel López Obrador. And did you have hopes during the campaign that if he was elected, that would bring about positive change? And if so, what are your senses now as we're getting closer to his coming to power, with discussions that there are negotiations taking place between the Trump administration and the incoming Andrés Manuel López Obrador administration?
Yes, we definitely had the hope that things would change. I mean, that's why such an overwhelming number of votes went for him, so many that the official party for decades couldn't even come up with a strategy to, like they have done in the past, to say that, no, they didn't win and the official party won again. It was so overwhelming, the number of voters in favor of López Obrador and his party. I think that we saw the news of the Washington Post saying that there was already either an agreement or they were talking about it. We also saw some Mexican news that said the opposite. According to what we read last, they were saying, no, we have never done anything. We haven't agreed with anything with him yet. So for one, let's remember Washington Post is owned by, Amazon.
Yes.
Amazon is already working with and getting contracts from ICE, from Homeland Security. They're trying to sell right now their ICE to ICE facial recognition software that is totally biased. It's racial profiling, basically, via technology. And at the same time, they would go with whatever Trump says, whatever they come out with lies, so many media ends up printing that. At the same time, I don't think they actually talked to the Mexican incoming government, and that's why we heard different things from Mexican independent media that immediately went and interviewed the incoming administration, saying, oh, is it true that you have this? And they're like, no, we haven't. And that doesn't mean, though, that they're not talking about it. I'm pretty sure that they're talking about it. I don't believe they had come up with something, because one of the persons that was appointed to, let's say, kind of safety department, I think that would be the translation, the safety department in Mexico, something like that.
Yes.
During July, right after the elections, he had said that he would support the current administration's role in the enforcement of migrants in the Guatemala border. And people just came after him and said, that's ridiculous. You know, we didn't vote for this party to be in the same vote as we were with the official party before. And he had to retract. He had to change his mind and said, oops, I'm sorry, that was just my opinion, but I'll do whatever the president, the new elected president, wants us to do. So I think there's still some room to pressure the new administration coming in, but I think it's clear that the U.S. has a really big influence, not only in Mexico, but across the continent, and that's why we have migrants in the first place trying to flee, because the U.S. has created a lot of those conditions of which people are trying to flee.
I have just about 1 minute left. What do you think will happen with the thousands of members of the caravan that have come from Guatemala and that are now in Mexico trying to get into the United States? If they can't get into the United States, will they be able to find housing and start a life in Mexico, or will they have to go back to Honduras and to Guatemala? We have just about 45 seconds.
We know there are several organizations and communities in Mexico that are welcoming the migrants. So I'm really hopeful that many of them, majority of them, will be able to stay. Some of them are requesting temporary visas as well. But sadly, the federal police right now has been deporting a lot of them. So we just have the hope that the Mexican people will do the right thing and will keep them as long as possible.
Ms. Maru Mora Villapando, Mexican native, and you've been an outspoken activist for over 20 years. You were just the 2018 Globalist of the Year from the Seattle Globalist. So congratulations again on that. Thank you so much for coming back to the Critical Hour. Thank you for your work, and we look forward to having you back very soon.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. You've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you all for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.